In this mini lecture, we'll be looking at navigation by odours. Some of the major questions we'll address are: how do insects use scents to move through the environment? In particular, how do they use the stimuli to reach a target? And how important is scent for navigation versus scent to assess the food quality itself? Some of the attributes of odours as orientation signals. Positive attributes are that odours can be transmitted across a long range. They can be transmitted across physical barriers because where air can flow, odours as cues can also flow. They can be used in darkness, which is very different to visual stimuli. And the receiver is able to discriminate and make decisions about orientation based on the composition of the volatile that they're detecting. Some of the more negative attributes are that they can be slow to move, diluted by distance, and temporary in some ways. And localization of the source can be very difficult. Just as an exercise, compare these attributes with other sensory modalities: sound, vision, taste. Taste is not a good long distance orientation mechanism in most cases. We need to understand what an odour gradient is. And the best way for us to do this is to visualise an odour plume itself. And there's a video link in the other learning resources. It takes you to a YouTube site where they talk quite a bit about the methods for looking at the structure of an odour plume. The diagram you see here is typical odour plume structure, perhaps moving from left to right, or right to left, I'm not sure. But the structure is very complex. This is two-dimensional, but that complexity, those filaments, the eddies, etc., would be present three-dimensionally. Now imagine if you were given the task of following this odour plume to its source. One of the logical things to do would be to find a high concentration and follow that along its path. But you see, that would take you to a dead end very, very soon because of the filamentous nature of the odour plume. The reason they're so complex is that there are two things coming into play here. One is molecular diffusion. Let's imagine you put an odour source in a completely closed room. Over time, the odour would diffuse to fill the room at the same concentration. So there would be no gradient and no ability to orient to the source if you're relying on olfactory cues. But because air is usually moving, you get fluid dynamics coming into play. Air is a low-density fluid, basically, and eddies, whirlpools, etc., come into play. It's fluid dynamics, and the structure of the odour plume is based upon a combination of molecular diffusion and the formation of these fluid dynamic structures. So just from looking at these pictures, you can see that there'd be quite a challenge to insects to find the source of an odour. There's another thing that comes into play, and that's called the boundary layer effect. The actual structure of the antenna is quite important in the insect's ability to be able to detect an odour. If we look at this example on the right-hand side here, it's the antenna of a fly, and they have a very deep pit in the antenna, which has a whole bunch of sense organs sitting in the bottom of the pit. And it seems the rationale for the putting, you know, evolving these types of structures with sense organs in pits is to reduce the effect of the boundary layer, to actually increase the size of the boundary layer so that the animal is not subject to these high frequency moment to moment changes in concentration due to odour plume structure. These particular receptors, IR40A, they're ionotropic receptors that detect humidity. So the fact that they're buried in these pits suggests that there's an advantage to the insect in finding or detecting humidity in not being able to detect the moment-to-moment filament structures, but to get an overall impression of the current humidity. So perhaps these receptors in pits might not be good for orientation towards the humidity source, but they give the animal an indication of what the general humidity is. So they're sacrificing rapid detection for slow detection, but they're not subject to the short-term inaccuracies. On the other hand, the surface of the antenna has many, many olfactory receptors where it's an advantage to be able to detect filaments and moment-to-moment changes in concentration. So chemical information in an odour plume, it can be very basic, like binary. Do I detect or do I not detect a particular odour? Animals often switch to vision when a signal is detected. So sometimes odours are not used for orientation, but they're used to cause the insect to change its behaviour and rely on a different sensory input, in this case vision. But more often, and something we're more concerned with, is concentration gradients. The insects need to be able to detect the source and know which direction to fly or walk. And intermittency of the chemical information is important, as we've looked at in looking at the structure of the odour plume. Fluid flow information. The direction of flow is detected visually. Insects can detect fixed points in the landscape. But think, if you're a flying animal, you're moving through the air. And if the air is moving itself, then it's very difficult to know which direction to orient if you've got to orient your flight. So they need to be able to distinguish airflow created by movement of the odour plume from their own movement within the medium, and that's quite a challenge. The direction of flow is actually detected by other sensory systems, such as mechanoreceptors that are moved back by flight, antennal deflection. The Johnston's organs seem to be important in detecting flight, giving feedback on flight. And the visual system is really important in this regard, so that they have cues, optic flow cues, that tell them what direction they're moving. Now, commonly animals move upwind or upstream on detecting the odorant. That's a pretty basic behaviour. Sometimes they regularly turn across the plume. So they're purposefully not staying in the plume, but it's as if they're trying to get out of the plume. You can see that this could be informative. This would give information about the origin of the odour source. I need to introduce some words: taxis and kinesis. Scientists have been studying animal orientation for years and years, and this terminology has developed around it. And you need to know the difference between kinesis and taxis. And I think this diagram on the right-hand side is probably a good summary. A kinesis is a behaviour where the animal changes its behaviour when it detects an odour, but it doesn't actually measure the concentration of the odour and make a targeted move towards it. Rather, it just changes some other aspect of its behaviour. So look at kinesis, look at orthokinesis. It's a type of kinesis where the speed of movement depends on the stimulus intensity. Now, intuitively, you would think, what's the point of that? But in fact, in many animals, just changing the rate of movement when they detect something that they would like to orient to, changing the rate of movement increases the likelihood that they will encounter the source, and then other stimuli can come into play, such as gustation and feeding. Another type of kinesis is clinokinesis, where the rate of turning depends on the stimulus intensity, and we'll look at that in the next slide. Taxis, on the other hand, are directed orientation. So they need to be, animals that use a taxis need to be able to compare signal strength to direct their orientation. And there are two primary types or subtypes of taxis, clinotaxis and tropotaxis. Clinotaxis is temporal comparisons of sequential stimulus samples. So it's sampling through time and making a decision. If the concentration is higher than it was a second ago, I'm on the right path, so I'll maintain that path. If it's lower, I'll do a turn. And that way, you can see clinotaxis is a rather efficient way of taking an animal to this odor, the source of the odor. Tropotaxis is even more efficient, where it's simultaneous spatial comparisons of stimulus samples. So think of an insect with two antennae, then the insect can detect in the brain, integrate the information coming from the two antennae to be able to interpret that there's stronger stimulus on my right antenna, therefore if I turn right, I'm heading towards the origin of the odor source. So it's the most sophisticated type of orientations we've talked about so far. So taxis and kinesis. The subtypes of kinesis are orthokinesis and clinokinesis. The subtypes of taxis are clinotaxis and tropotaxis. Taxis is singular and taxis, T-A-X-E-S, is plural. We'll look at an example of kinesis here. As I said, they're undirected reactions. This example I like is from a scientist called Vincent Detier. He wrote a book called The Hungry Fly. He started working in the 60s on insect gustatory systems and was quite the pioneer of much of this work. He discovered what he called the fly dance, that if you had a hungry fly that had been starved for a period and put a drop of sucrose in the middle of an arena, that the insect would immediately consume that drop if it contacted it with its feet. The gustatory stimulus would bring out the proboscis extension reflex. It would drink this tiny drop of sugary water, not enough to sate it. But he noticed that after they drank that drop, that they started a high frequency of turning, and that frequency of turning and the duration of the turning depended on the sugar concentration. Let's look at the 0.125 molar path. X marks the spot where they drank the droplet. They had a higher rate of turning, but it gradually tapered back to a more or less low turning rate. There are two examples of 0.125 molar. If we then look at the two examples of 0.5 molar, you can see that the path taken by the insect after it consumed the drop is much more convoluted. And with 1 molar, it's far more convoluted. So these are undirected reactions. The animal just goes into a turning behavior and a locomotory rate change as soon as it gets this stimulus. And you can prove that it's not a real search pattern. They're not usually using any visual cues, because you can pick the animal up immediately after it's consumed that droplet and put it into another arena, and it will still show exactly the same turning behavior. So they're not using visual stimuli, and they're not using directed stimuli. It's not a taxis. It's a real kinesis, just a change in rate of movement and turning frequency. So what apparently looks like a search pattern does ultimately work as a search pattern, and increasing the rate of turning means that they're more likely to find more of the same stimulus because they frequently occur in clumps. That's why insects are good at exploiting clumped resources. Now, you'll find a bunch of other words that are used to describe olfactory orientation. Rheotaxis means facing the flow of direction. So it's often used in aquatic animals, a crab. The animal faces the direction of flow if it finds a stimulation. Do you call it olfactory in the water? I'm not sure. And will orient then towards the source. Chemotaxis is following a chemical gradient. Chemotropotaxis is where they're simultaneously making spatial comparisons of chemical signals. Chemoclinotaxis is another term you'll come across. Optomotor anemotax, optomotor meaning the visual system feeding into the locomotory system, such as flight or walking. And you'll see the term counter-turning or zigzag patterns. They're very commonly seen in insects when they're orienting. I'll just show you this. I like this example of early example of from 1976 of studying insect orientation. Here the cockroach was stuck onto a stick and allowed to hold onto this weird spherical-like structure. But the idea was to test their orientation to a potential pheromone. Rather than using Y-tube olfactory tests, they used this system with the animal constrained, and they hold on to this foam ball. And so at each decision, as they're moving forward, the animal naturally will walk. As they move forward, they have to make decisions. Do I go left or right? So that's why it's called a Y-ring globe. They need to make a series of decisions. And you can puff pheromone from either the right side or the left side and assess whether it makes a right-hand turn or a left-hand turn every time it comes to one of these decision points. So it's a very artificial situation, but it provided useful information, and the animals did in fact orient towards these chemicals that were being tested as olfactory cues, as pheromones. Methods for tracking paths and walking insects are much more sophisticated now. On the right-hand side here, we see these foam balls with a pattern on it. It was developed at Queensland Brain Institute to study orientation of Drosophila, walking Drosophila, or honeybee, and can accommodate other insects. The ball is a sphere of foam. It's suspended on an air current, like a funnel with air flowing through it, and put the ball on top. So the ball is actually not touching any physical surface. And so it rotates very, very readily if an insect is glued to a pin or a holder and just allowed to rest its feet and hold onto that substrate. When it starts walking, the sphere will move in any direction, and a video camera is used to monitor the direction of movement over time and then recreate that as a path, as if the animal was walking on a flat two-dimensional substrate. And you can see in the bottom that the animals can be put in front of an LED screen that simulates the environment. It's very rough, but it's produced very reliable, repeatable information about insects' orientation towards visual stimuli. Many insects will orient, like Drosophila, for example, will orient towards a bar. If that's all it can see in its environment is a vertical bar, it will always walk towards it. And you can then move the position of the bar and see if the animal changes its position by looking at the recorded track. So there's a lot of computerized systems now for tracking insect movement. You can do it in an open loop system, meaning there's no visual feedback, or you can do it in a closed loop system so that as the animal walks on the ball, the computer can pick up that movement and change the environment as if the animal was moving in a real environment. So it provides very sophisticated movement monitoring system. In addition, video analysis has moved leaps and bounds, and there's lots of freewares available now that will allow you to track insect paths from long-term video recordings. And even if the insects encounter each other, the systems can make intelligent decisions about which individual is which based on their trajectory before they came towards each other. Let's look at odor-guided navigation in ants. Ants are famous for following trails, and they're incredibly efficient at it. And this is a neat little experiment done on ants, where the ants following a pheromone trail, ants as they find a food source, they'll return to the nest using visual orientation cues. But as they do so, they'll dab their abdomen onto the substrate and leaving a pheromone trail. Now that pheromone dissipates over time. That's part of the reason why it's so efficient. So trails are reinforced by other individuals if they also follow that trail and get food. If the trail is not maintained, if other insects don't use it, then it fades. And so this mechanism itself produces very efficient paths to food sources. Video tracking of individuals along pheromone path shows that they use both antennae simultaneously to orient towards along the trail, to stay on the trail. If a left antenna is removed, as in B here, they veer to the intact side. So you've upset their simultaneous sampling capability, and so you can see the path becomes slightly irregular. If you cross the antennae and glue them in a crossed configuration, then the path gets really confused. It's a cruel little trick to play on an insect, but it just shows the importance of this simultaneous input from both sides. It's called tropochemotaxis, simultaneously sampling using two sensory inputs. As I mentioned, the pheromone trails are short-lived and they're refreshed by use. Another interesting aspect of orientation along paths is it's suggested that even the shape of the bifurcations or in the path can be detected by the insect. That if the direction is toward the food source, the ants have choices based on similar angles. But if they're going back to the nest, one acute angle and one obtuse angle, and they'll choose the obtuse angle, and that gets them back to the nest. Because pheromone paths, in this case, don't have a inherent polarization, as in the odor itself doesn't tell them which way is the nest and which way is the food source. Whereas if it was purely olfactory coming from the nest, there would be a diffusion gradient they could follow, or filaments of odor plume. But because it's an olfactory stimulant that is dabbed onto the substrate, there's no inherent directionality in the pheromone signal. Another interesting experiment that's been done was to examine the importance of bilateral symmetry, or both sets of antennae, in a cockroach. This diagram just shows the experiments. Let's look at the top left. This is a Periplaneta American cockroach with 4 centimeter long intact antennae. And the experiment was to allow them to make a choice to orient towards an odor source for food, and then snip off either one side or the other, or shorten the lengths of both antennae. You can see there both antennae are intact, 100% success rate. If one antenna is removed, that success rate is reduced, and one antenna is not significantly different to the other antenna if removed. So there's as long as they've got one antenna, they can still make the correct choice in approximately 3/4 of the times. When the natural antennae are shortened to 2 centimeters, the half of the receptors are missing, but they still make the right choice in 100% of cases. So you've reduced the sensory input, but they're still able to discriminate. But if there's only one antenna and it's cut to half its length, you can see that the rate of errors increases slightly. When you only have a very short pair of antennae, some errors start to creep in. This is the third row in the first column. And if we go down even further, when there's very, very little input, you can see that the error rate increases a lot. And if only one antenna, it's very, very high error rate, 100% failure. So the essence of this is that lateralization is not so important. It's the overall numbers of receptors available to the animal that allows it to make correct decisions. So just sensory input, the number of sensory neurons available to send input is important. So the animals must be moving their heads backwards and forwards, side to side, to make decisions that when they're coming to these decision points, what direction to take. Now, we talked about the animals moving from side to side. That's a very frequent phenomenon we see when a moth is travelling along a plume. This is more just observational, very difficult to quantify this, but people have been using things called wind tunnels, where you have a long container and have an airflow along it, and then a source of odour, and then allow a moth to be freed at one end and just record its path as it flies towards the odour. Video has frequently been used, but as I mentioned to you, now we're able to get a lot more three-dimensional information out of videos. We'll talk a little bit more about that in the next few slides. But here was the intuitive explanation is that the animal, once it's in the plume, it does what's called a surge, an upwind movement, that should take it to the odour source. But then because the nature of the plume is a little unpredictable, it'll end up coming out of the odour plume. Then it starts to show this zigzag behaviour called casting, cast from left to right. So it's a change in behaviour, very frequent turns, and there's a high likelihood, as we saw in the flies walking on a surface after they got a sugar drop, that high rate of turning increases the chance that the animal will re-encounter the plume and then it will surge upwind once again. So combinations of surges and casting end up getting the insect to the odour source. That's called optomotor anemotaxis because the animal uses its optical system to know which direction to fly once it does re-encounter the odour plume. Optomotor anemotaxis, moving upwind. Blood-feeding insects are pretty important. Mosquitoes are very efficient at finding hosts. And some work studying their orientation mechanisms and the stimulants that they use has been carried out. The reference to this paper is in the online material. It seems that fluctuating carbon dioxide levels initiates upwind flight. So the insects might be resting somewhere on a plant, they detect CO2, they start flying. Now, if they're flying upwind, there's a likelihood that they'll find the host. And then it seems that the fluctuating CO2 reduces the threshold for skin odorants. So the animal is becoming sensitized to alternative attractants. Skin odorants are things like lactic acid that are in our sweat. And the next step, flight near the host. An insect, a mosquito, is very, very small frequently in relation to the animal it's feeding on. So then it starts to look for other cues. A homogeneous cloud of skin odorants and odor cue and visual cues allow the animal to make a decision that it's near a host, and then it will go into landing behavior. And heat and humidity very frequently come into play in that landing behaviour. And once the animal has landed, obviously, then it uses other stimuli to feed. So CO2 and other host-based odorants, there's a cascade of the importance of these different cues, and the visual system comes into play as well. When we talk about olfactory orientation, we tend to talk about it on its own, but as we've seen, that visual orientation comes into play an awful lot. Otherwise, the olfactory system alone is not very efficient at allowing an animal to find a host. There's some very detailed work being done by this guy, Mike Dickinson, using very sophisticated wind tunnels, which are shown in the top left of this diagram. And they devised a system to have a very structured odour plume that's very direct and not much filamentous nature in it. So it took a lot of design, and they were able to use some complex technology to be able to actually visualise odour plumes using a special stimulant. And that's what's shown in the heat map diagram. You can see that this odour source is very linear and it has a concentration gradient from high to low on the outside. So once they knew where that odour plume was, they could release insects into the tunnel and record their movement with a series of multiple video cameras, and then take that video information and recreate insects' paths in 3D. I won't go into all of the details of the insects' paths, but the outcomes were quite interesting. That 190 milliseconds, that's 190 thousandths of a second, almost 0.2 of a second, after encountering a plume, the flies increase their flight speed and turn upwind. They use visual cues to determine the wind direction. You can see in that wind tunnel it's got a checked background that provides a lot of visual cues for the insects to know what direction they're moving. So as soon as they encounter the plume, they turn upwind using visual cues. Now, because this is there's a delay there, the flies pass right through the plume shortly after they get into it. But 450 milliseconds, approximately half a second after losing the plume, they initiate a series of vertical and horizontal casts. And that casting takes them back into the plume. And they use visual cues to maintain a crosswind heading. So rather than going upwind, they go crosswind and cast. So this eventually gets them up closer to the odour source. And they show an enhanced attraction to small visual features once they're in the odour plume. So this is similar to what we got from the mosquito example, that changes the olfactory system, high olfactory cue concentrations, and the animal switches into the visual system to make decisions where to land. And the actual computer modelling show that the delays are close to optimal for following a plume. So you can see that there's been an evolutionary adaptation to optimise these orientation reflexes in Drosophila. Okay, just there's on the online material as well, there are these links. It would be very, I think, good for you to have a look at Mike Dickinson's TED Talk. It's quite interesting. And a few other sources of information to have a look at. There are more references in the online material as well.